Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Mr. Javon McCormick, author of The Modern Leader. He has written an amazing book that captures the poignancy of the modern interracial experience that defines not just America, but really each of us as an individual. And with that, I'd like to welcome Mr. McCormick. Thank you.
My man, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Always excellent. I woke up this morning, family's healthy, I'm healthy, so everything else is up to me to make the most of the day.
Well, I think people can really benefit from what you have written, particularly the poignancy in the words. And I think that it's incredibly important that people really understand the urgency of your message. And I know that we have a few kind of standard questions that we want to begin with, but I have to almost start with this. It's a certain urgency in the words that you talk about and really understanding future problems, future issues of identity in corporate America. Why now is the urgency so poignant for people to understand the messages in your book?
You know, I'm going to be very, very, very fair to that question. I personally believe the urgency should have existed a long time ago. We, you know, here's how I live life, and I believe this really explains people as a whole. Whatever we're not changing, we're choosing. And so when you say the urgency, my opinion, the urgency's always been there, but it's only been there for a select group of people. And so I've had so many people ask me this question, because I always talk about the broken playbook, the broken business playbook. Mm-hmm. You know, you read it within the book, and people have asked me, well, if the playbook is so broken, why did we run the playbook for so long? Yeah. And my answer to them is, well, I firmly believe the people who created the playbook are also the people who created the phrase, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Because the playbook worked for a select group of people. It did not work unless you could somehow navigate your way into this playbook for others. So the in my opinion, the sense of urgency has always been there for a select group of people. Why I feel that the country has now made it a sense of urgency is, you know, one could argue that the spark started during the George Floyd murder. Well, mm-hmm. It was a place, but as I said, during the George Floyd murder, you know, what was sad, in my opinion, people asked me, well, hey, how do you feel about that? You know, did you see the video of the guy who said, I can't breathe? And what frustrated me is people didn't realize I could look you in the eye and say, which guy are you talking about? Because that's not new. Wow. And that was the problem that I had. The frustration is people were up in arms because here was this blatant video of it, but that wasn't new. There yeah. were other videos. This isn't new that it happened before. So because that was such in our face and just such, and it was blatant. And I'm going to call this part out as well. The other part why I feel that it was heightened so much is we can't forget we were in the middle of the virus.
Yeah.
41 million people in this country were unemployed at the time. And then we saw that video. And I feel more people saw that video because we were all confined to our homes. And now we all saw this video and we were pissed. And it gave us a reason to take to the streets and express our frustration. But like I've said to so many people said, well, you know, this time's different. This time's different. And I go, I'm not sure. You know, the only thing that's different is, like I said, 41 million Americans were unemployed and we had been stuck in the house for 2.5 months. That's what was different. But the actual killing of a Black man by an officer, that wasn't new. That wasn't different. And so again, the sense of urgency, in my opinion, has always been there. We just have some factors now that have maybe opened the eyes of a few more people.
Yeah. Well said. And it's clear throughout the book that you have seen things and lived experiences that few can speak to, as you had just mentioned. We see these snapshots of experience, and it forms this broader narrative, almost as if you're in the moment and then reflecting back at different vignettes throughout your life. You talk about inclusion. You talk about understanding in the professional world. How did this narrative come about? How did it form? And how is it manifesting in your current understanding of the George Floyd situation?
You know, it's interesting. When we speak on the topic of inclusion, where that came from directly for me is many people in this country forget or even don't know. It wasn't until 1967 that I was technically legally allowed to be born in this country because my dad's Black, my mom's white. And so growing up mixed race in the 70s, Black people didn't like me because I was half white. White people didn't like me because I was half Black. And there was always this identity issue. And you weren't always welcomed in the Black community. You weren't always welcomed in the white community. And so it was, okay, I want to be included. And what was sad as a kid, I wanted to be accepted. I wanted to belong. And because those words were so hard hitting as a kid, now as an adult, I don't want anyone to be accepted. I don't want anyone to be I belong, because belonging implies someone else doesn't. But if you welcome someone, welcoming people, it does not matter who you voted for. It does not matter your race. It does not matter how you identify. It doesn't matter if you believe in God or if you don't believe in God. Are you human? Yes, welcome. So welcome became a very important topic to me, or word to use, because like I said, I damn sure don't want to be tolerated. I don't want to be accepted. I'm not applying to college. I'm not applying to get into your country club. I don't want to be accepted. And again, you're seeing this now. There are people who are putting this word on the end of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. I don't want to belong, because that implies someone else does not belong. So it comes down to welcome. We want to welcome you into our organization, and we want to continue to make sure you are welcomed when you're a part of the organization. And here's the irony of this. This is the funny part. In America, apartments, condos, houses, trailers, what is in front of millions of doors in this country? A welcome mat.
Yeah.
Yet and still, we're not a very welcoming people for different people.
Yeah, and certainly the narratives that were conveyed in your book would suggest as much. There is a transformation that's clear in this book, where you talk about past vulnerabilities and then present wisdoms. And it's clear in how you're processing these things. And it makes your understanding of inclusion and some of the kind of simplified notions of it all the more powerful. When did you come up with this understanding that I know how to take all these negative experiences and create wisdom out of it? Did it just appear, or was it consciously recognized?
I believe over time, because I can go back to the first time I really experienced learning those lessons, processing those lessons, and then even executing on those lessons. And I'll give you the very first one that may be one of the most powerful moments in my life, when my mom and I were standing in line for our monthly allotment of welfare. You know, back in the 70s, you had to stand in line for, you know, 3-4 hours to get your free handout. And while we were standing there in line, there was an older white lady who was standing in front of us. And she looked down at me, she looked up at my mom, and then she spit in my mom's face. Wow. And she called her a nigger lover. And it was in that moment for me, 8 years old, that I had realized, wow, okay, no matter what I do in life, there's always going to be someone who doesn't like me because I'm mixed race. There's going to be someone who doesn't believe mixed race should happen. You shouldn't have mixed race relationships. There are going to be people who don't believe my mother should have had a child with a black man. And so because of that, at 8 years old, I realized, wow, no matter what I do in life, everyone's not going to like me. So in that moment at eight, I said, okay, too bad. I'm not going to spend my life trying to make everybody like me because it's never going to happen. And that really is where I started looking at the lessons of life and trying to make the most of them. You know, we all have some type of adversity we've gone through or trauma or you know, whatever has happened to you in your life. You know, we all have a story. But it's how do we view the story? Yeah, I believe there is a lesson or a positive in every aspect of your life, no matter how traumatic. You know, for me, and I'll shut up after this. For me, being sexually molested as a child, the age of six, 7, 8 years old, you know, people are like, well, what was the lesson? It took me time. But what I realized was, I remember one of those last moments that happened to me, and in that particular time, it was really harsh. It was harder than, you know, she was slapping me in the face, punching me in the head, screaming at me, telling me to do it right. And I remember saying to myself, okay, I am never going to be in a position where I don't know what to do. Yeah. And when I look back, then going forward in my life, I've always tried to observe the room, pay attention, what's going on, and put myself in a position that I know what to do. Now, some people can say, well, I still don't see the positive from being sexually molested. The positive for me was I developed a mindset of, okay, always know what to do. Think through, pay attention, figure out what to do. So that was the lesson and the positive that came from that moment.
Yeah, I remember distinctively when I came across that part in the book, and had to do a lot with the kind of your early memories of your father and some of the associates that your father would run with. It was a very powerful part of the book, and I would encourage anybody who gets to that part to really pay close attention, because it demonstrates a complexity to you. It demonstrates a person who's not just a survivor, but somebody who understands what it means to take an ownership of the experience. And I really got that out of you. And when you talk about succumbing to these pressures of experience, you then translate that into the professional world and the adversarial professional world, how many of the cutthroat mindsets that you grew up with could be in many ways replicated in the corporate world. You explain how certain things happen to you, and you also explain how you succumbed to some of those mindsets as well. And I thought that it really brought out this very nuanced mindset in which you realized there is a real politic to life, and that it can't always be the idealized version of yourself. Where did that mindset come from? Was it born out of reacting to the experiences in the moment, or did you start to then realize that this is a wisdom that I've developed?
Here's what's interesting. This is the way I would say it. Many people who have formal educations, they rely on those formal educations. Many people who grow up in nice middle class, two-parent homes, mom and dad, you know, there's lessons that they're being taught that they don't even know they're being taught. And I'll give you an example of this. In the low-income communities that I grew up in, a two-year-old child, by the age of two, they've been exposed to 2,000 words. Mm. A two-year-old child, like my kids, by the time they were two, they've been exposed to 30,000 words. So for me to directly answer your questions, I had to take the lessons that I learned and somehow make those transfer into How am I going to succeed? Because I don't have the two-parent home. I didn't have someone to groom me, teach me, coach me, mentor me. So I had to take the tools that I had and that I was given and navigate the world in front of me and at times make those lessons translate to somehow get into the old playbook. And that's really all I did. And you know, I'll be very transparent and vulnerable here. You know, my mother was a prostitute.
Yeah.
So I never saw my mom as a kid. I never saw my mom be treated well, be respected. My dad was a pimp. My dad, I never saw him respect women, treat women. So, and I don't blame my mom or dad for this. I take full accountability, responsibility, which is something where so many people are missing now. I don't blame either of them, but here's what I didn't receive. I didn't know how to have a relationship. I didn't know what a healthy relationship even looked like. So at the age of about 39, I struggled. I was a monster in relationships. I was a beast, horrible. I did not treat women with respect. I was ugly. It was wrong the way I was. And so I look at that, and at 37, 38, I said to myself, okay, you taught yourself business. You taught yourself how to navigate that playbook. You taught yourself how to make money in the stock market. You need to teach yourself how to have a healthy relationship. And so, you know, again, personal accountability. I don't look back at my mom and dad and say, oh, well, you know, it's their fault. Look what I was born into. No, I look back and say, okay, why am I like this? Okay. I never had a model of what a healthy relationship looked like. Okay, great. We've identified it. Now that we know why this is, what are we going to do about it? We're not going to pull the sheet over our head, lay in bed and be depressed and cry and be upset that, oh, you know, it's their fault. They should know that that's bullshit.
Yeah. Wow. You know, as you're talking, I'm kind of just reflecting on a lot of the stories you mentioned in the book. And I'm thinking about Maria in the mail carrier. And I'm thinking about you with your mom sitting on the curbside. It's very hard not to get caught up in the emotion in your words as you're detailing this. And so it's an really amazing to kind of hear you articulate the experiences that are mentioned in the book after I've read them, because they provide a unique depth to it, and I appreciate that. So thank you for that. I want to talk about something that was a pervasive theme throughout the book, and that's names. You talk about the moment you went from Javon to JT and back to Javon. That's a big moment for you. You talk about Ashley and Shamika in detailing the inherent subtle biases that people go through based on their lived experiences and the inherent inequalities that form because of that. Why so much emphasis on the name? Why is it so powerful to you?
Think about this. Outside of the visual, when we see someone for the first time, we can all say we're not judgmental. Oh, I don't judge people. We're humans. Yes, you do. The moment you see someone, you like, oh, that's a nice shirt, or ooh, I wouldn't wear that. You know, and so we're humans. So when you see someone, that's the visual is the first judgment. The second judgment is someone introduces themselves. And if they introduce themselves as Rayvante, you're already forming a judgment of Rayvante and his name. Here's what's interesting. So many people, depending on how Rayvante speaks with you, depending on what you learn about Rayvante, you're going to form a judgment. Now, if Rayvante doesn't speak very well, and Rayvante reveals to you that he's from a low-income community and his dad's a pimp, and his dad had 23 kids, you're going to have a deep thought on Rayvante. But if Rayvante introduced himself and said, hey, I'm Rayvante, and then you start to learn that, oh, wow, Rayvante speaks incredibly well, And Revante went to Harvard. Oh, Revante's from a two-parent home out in Orange County. Now you've got a whole different view of Revante. So it's interesting with names. You know, some people, and let's call it what it is, it mainly comes from what we would say are ethnic names. Because if Steve introduces himself to you, you're not thinking those things right off the bat. So names are very powerful, because it's, in my opinion, it's the second thing that we are introduced to with the person. First is visual. Second is when they introduce themselves and they say their name to you. And here's the real downside of this. If you don't even get to have a visual and you send your resume in somewhere, the first judgment is your name. Mm. And so if at the top of that resume, it says Revante Jenkins, they may not even make it down to find out that you went to Harvard, got an MBA from Harvard, and maybe even went to Harvard Medical School. They may not even make it down your resume to find out those things about you, because at the top of it, it says Revante Jenkins.
Yeah. It's very interesting that you put it in that way. Visual and name, because there's nothing inherently rational about that. And you use this, it's one of the many powerful phrases that I picked up. You discuss bias and discrimination as we breathe it. It's subtle. It's not rational. It's subconscious. Then you also talk about later in the book about the hypocrisies in diversity training, hiring practices, and you kind of alluded to the concept of quote unquote belonging. Is there a common ground, or will there always be a certain I don't know if hypocrisy is the right word, but a certain misalignment when you're trying to take subtle subconscious concepts like bias and discrimination and codify them in the professional world where they're designed to create a sense of fairness that is definitionally acceptable to everybody's definition of fair?
I believe you just nailed it. That's the key. And again, you saw how we started our call before we even started recording. I'm a very positive, optimistic person.
Yeah.
But the one piece I do believe, and maybe this is a negative, I do believe you're always going to have some sort of racism in the world. I don't believe you can ever bring everyone to the same type thinking. And that's just something I don't want to say we have to accept. We just have to continue to work with, because it's not going anywhere. And some of it comes from just a lack of understanding. Some of it comes from a lack of some people don't care. Some people don't want to understand. Some people don't give a damn about what goes on in the low economic communities and how we can support those communities. And okay, so when you have those thoughts and opinions, I don't believe you're ever going to put in place where it's fair across the board. And again, growing up the way I did, mixed race and all of the chaos and my parents and just the system as a whole, I learned early on, this shit's not fair. And yeah. So it may not be our fault that we have this system, society. It may not be our fault, but it is all of our responsibility to continuously try to improve it. So, you know, even with that, you have so many people that just want to walk around and point the finger and blame why. This is why, this is why, this is why. Okay, well, all right, now that we've got the whys out, what are we going to do about it? And there's some people that just rather sit back and continue to point the finger and blame and rather than actually bringing actual change to the why. And again, you know, when you say the hypocrisy, here's one for me. And this I do not agree with this. Right now, if we're watching, you know, TikTok, Instagram, a video, whatever, and we see some white lady in Starbucks screaming about her coffee and how it was made the wrong way. The first thing everyone was, oh, Karen, freaking Karen, she's a Karen now. And everybody laughs. Everybody, it's a joke. Oh, she's a Karen. All right. Let's do this. We see a black lady in Starbucks screaming about her coffee. And someone posts or says, damn Shaniqua, we are going to lose our minds as a country. We're going to just absolutely lose it. And oh my God, you racist ass. Da, da, da. Wait a minute. Hold on. Hold on. So it's okay for us to mark a white lady, Karen, but we're not going to mark a black woman, a Shaniqua. The fact of it is, how about we don't do either? This lady was losing it. This lady needs to be more professional. She needs to be more understanding. She needs to be whatever. Okay, have that conversation. Call her out on her lack of respect for other people. Beautiful. To name call, that's ridiculous. That's absolutely ridiculous. And why I point the finger at that, man, I can't tell you how many times I was called zebra, half-breed, Oreo cookie, chocolate vanilla squirrel, color confused. And so, you know, we live in this world where we say sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Bullshit. Words have meaning. Words are powerful. Words hurt. And so I believe that if we're not going to call someone out for being a Shaniqua, whatever that is, we shouldn't call someone out for being a Karen, whatever that is, because it does not help in bringing us together. Let's highlight that this lady's acting a damn fool and is disrespectful. She needs to learn some manners, you know, call all that out. But why name call? That does nothing.
Yeah, your response reminds me of one of your quotations. You can't put a price on empathy.
Right.
And you highlighted empathy as a possible solution to a lot of these double standards, biases that come up. How do we realistically put empathy in a way where it can be, for lack of a better term, institutionalized in the corporate world, or somehow recognize that emphasizing empathy is both good for your career and good for you as a person?
The big piece to me is just really having the open conversations of understanding, you know, and to be not to weaponize or demonize someone else for their circumstances. If, you know, this white guy over here is named Blake Wesley and he grew up in an upper class two-parent home and went to all the great schools and maybe they had a vacation house in the Hamptons. Okay, well, don't demonize Blake Wesley because he was born into a great family. That's a beautiful thing. You know, that's what we all aspire to have. It's what I want for my children. So, but we shouldn't weaponize that. Here to me is the only time privilege is a negative thing, because right now we've weaponized the word privilege in this country. It's specifically white privilege. And privilege is only negative when you don't use the privilege you have to elevate others. That's the only time privilege is negative. And so what I mean by that, and people are shocked when I say this, I tell people, yeah, I'm privileged. And they're like, what? I go, to come from where I come from, I go, I know things about this country that most people are never going to see, experience, or even know exist. That's a privilege. And with this privilege that I have now, I have a deep responsibility to give back to these communities that I come from, because I have learned lessons on how can we get out of those situations. So privilege is only a negative if you don't use it to elevate others. So Blake Wesley, who comes from that great family, two-parent home, summer vacation in the Hamptons, Blake Wesley, yeah, you become a negative when you don't use that privilege to elevate others.
Well said. I want to end with how you ended the book with excerpts from a letter written by your late mother. And as I mentioned to you before we started the recording, I started welling up in a book laced with so many powerful emotional moments. This was by far the most emotional and really touched me in a certain way that a book has really done in a long time. So first off, congratulations on that. How do you reconcile the emotional pain of your past with the sense of understanding and love for your mother that's so powerfully conveyed?
You know, I had the absolute blessing, honor, gift, privilege that in my mother passed away March 22nd, literally about a month before my mom and I had a 2-hour call, which was unusual. We weren't usually on the phone for 2 hours. And my mom always for years has walked around with this guilt of when I lived with my dad from the ages of 9 to 15, and she's always had a guilt because that's truly from 9 to 15, all hell broke loose for me. That was by far the hardest time of my life. And she had a guilt for that because I was with my dad. And in February, that last in-depth conversation we had, I said to my mom, I go, look, you need to let that shit go. You need to set it down and walk away from it. Because for me, you gave me the blessing of life, period. And so I am actually happy that I went through that time period because of the lessons that I took away, of the things that I got to learn. I can make a strong argument that from 9 to 15, I learned lessons that are still serving me to this day. And had it not been for that time period, I would have never learned those lessons. So I told my mom, I'm grateful. I'm thankful for that time period. She needs to set that down. I understand from a parent, from a mother, you know, she had that deep guilt about it. But I told her, I said, look, here's the deal. You gave me life. You taught me how to survive. But it was up to me to teach myself how to live and thrive. And so, yeah, you taught me how to survive, but I had to teach myself how to live and thrive. And you gave me life, period. So that's how for me, a lot of peace came from it. And then the last part, I will say something that I do still struggle with. The hardest part when my mom passed away is my mom and I have the same last name. And my mom received that name in the orphanage. She has no clue where, why, how she got this last name. But when I was born, I was all she had in the world. That was it. And so for her, she said, okay, I'm going to give this child my last name. So for the person who gave me my last name to have passed away and I'm it, that was a big struggle for me. You know, granted, now, you know, I have my wife, I have my 4 children, and they all have the last name McCormick, but still the originator for me of the last name, where it came from, and more important, not only where it came from my mom, but why she gave it to me, because that was all she had to give. That's a very you talk about eyes watering, my eyes are watering now, because that's, you know, it's all I have.
Yeah, no, it was a very powerful way to end the book, and thank you for sharing those memories. It was a journey to go through your book, and I feel I'm all the better for it. So thank you for offering that experience to the world.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
With that being said, I'd just like to put one final plug in. So please, whoever has made it this far into the podcast, please purchase Modern Leader by Mr. Jevon McCormick. It is a great read, and I recommend it to anybody who just wants to see what it's like to grow up with everything stacked against you, yet succeed at the highest level. So with that, Mr. McCormick, thank you for your time.
I appreciate it. This was awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.